My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're speaking about, it's more an update on the situation in Ukraine, but not so much about the fighting on the ground, right? It's just has been very tragic for the last 3 years. I don't think, I think we've spoken about this extensively in the past. However, there have been updates with regards to peace processes, and I think that's a very interesting topic for us to talk about, Balder.
Yes, hi Dario. Indeed, there potentially you could have a episode on Ukraine every week because, of course, there are always the diplomatic and military issues to discuss. But what you see overall is that Ukraine is increasingly pushed into a corner, especially the 2025 under the Trump administration, with the Europeans not being at all clear at to what extent they want to support Ukraine. And now they have, the Americans and the Russians have basically submitted this 28-point peace plan that is essentially a message to Kiev, to Zelensky, take it or you're going to be in big trouble. And that might be interesting to analyze because it's not at all obvious what Ukraine can and should do anymore.
And this, the same logic applies to other conflicts as well, right? So, I mean, Israel-Palestine, of course, I think we could, we have enough content potentially to talk about the situation there every week, right? Because, I mean, just as we predicted, a ceasefire is being violated, at least on a weekly basis. And the suffering continues, and the implementation, despite the fact that they now moved into phase two, as Trump told me the other day, right? There's no real progress to be made on the ground, and the same applies to Sudan as well, and all the other regions of the world that we've talked about in the past.
One difference, of course, is that Ukraine, at least nominally, can still say no to this plan. Also, this morning, it should be pointed out that the Kremlin has said that the Americans haven't made sufficient progress, so the Kremlin in itself is skeptical, but the Palestinians didn't have a choice. When they were presented with the peace plan, and I use peace plan loosely here because it was just a ceasefire and it had absolutely no longevity. But Zelensky still has a choice. The problem is that the choice becomes starker and starker because if he goes against the will of the White House and the United States decides to cut off any remaining weapon supplies, financial support, and all that, then it's going to be very hard for Ukraine to keep on fighting in the long term, especially with the Europeans not being clear in what they want to do. So there is a choice to be made. It's also not at all clear where the Russians stand on this, because like I said, they're skeptical. It is one of those situations where it seems to be all about Donald Trump not caring really about the complexity of the conflict at hand. Just like with Gaza, it is more about what Donald Trump wanting to be seen as the peacemaker, and if possible, a peacemaker that also brings in money and prestige to the United States.
I mean, we see this dynamic with all the other conflicts he has solved in the last few months as well, right? I mean, if I'm counting correctly, we're at 8 or 9 conflicts he has solved, according to himself, of course. We had the meeting between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo that Trump solved. Azerbaijan has been solved, but it's always a short-term ceasefire that doesn't really address any of the underlying issues. Because you mentioned, right, that Ukraine can say no, but that's the right, that's kind of the similarity I again see with Israel and Gaza, is that one party is basically completely ignored, and one party to the conflict, right? So not just a random stakeholder, but one of the parties to the conflict is not even included in these negotiations. So in Israel Gaza, that was the population or Hamas or whomever you want to define as the party to the conflict. And here with Ukraine, it was a peace plan negotiated between Russia and the United States, and then it was presented to the world and to Ukraine as well.
Yeah, and even the word negotiated is a bit of a generous term, because in many ways it was just a Russian wish list that the Americans copied. I mean, the U.S. envoy, Witkoff, Steve Witkoff, he is very clearly a Putin sycophant. And I don't say this as someone who's, well, I don't like him. I'm not a fan of Putin, but it's not an anti-Putin statement. It's just that this is a man who really deeply seems to admire Putin and is basically being given the wishes of the Russians to take home to his boss, to Donald Trump. And that's it. There is no negotiation in a serious form between the Americans and the Russians, right? It's essentially, we Russians want this. And then Trump adds a little bit here and there to make it more about him and to give it a business vibe so that the Americans economically benefit from it. And that's about it. And I think an interesting similarity there with the others that you mentioned, also with Armenia, Azerbaijan, or as Donald Trump calls it, Albania and Azerbaijan, or Gaza, is that the actual process where the Americans are involved is not really that valuable, right? The conflict is settled outside of the negotiation room. And then the Americans come in and say, okay, well, we will now guarantee this status quo. And in exchange for that guarantee, we want the recognition. We want the respect and preferably even some financial compensation for that. But if you compare that to previous peace processes where, for example, the UN was involved and not just the United States in the 20th century, there is a long drawn out process of actually people sitting at a table, all parties, and trying to negotiate something with the United States or the United Nations being the honest broker, basically not trying to take sides. In this case, the conflict is essentially done. This is the situation where we're at. We're not going to negotiate any complex things. We're just going to put a stamp on it and freeze it from this moment on and say, this is now peace created by Donald Trump.
Because you said it looks like a plan that's basically written by Russia or just copied Russian positions. I mean, that's one of the factors we actually don't know yet. Because this was presented by the United States and Russia. And then very quickly after it was presented, there were some senators who were briefed on the matter, allegedly by Marco Rubio, right? And who I think, right, who are also very critical of this plan, and then basically said that this was the United States was not responsible for the release of this plan, right? This was more like a Russian starting point to begin negotiations based on this. Also, some of the language in there seemed a little off, right? Like it was kind of translated from Russian into English, the senator in question, right, Mike Rounds, kind of said at the end that this was an essentially a Russian wish list, which then led to the very funny reactions by Europeans, where Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk wrote on Twitter, and I quote, "It would be good to know for sure who's the author of the plan and where it was created," end quote, to which then Marco Rubio answered that, hey, this was indeed authored by us and is based on the input from previous and ongoing relations with Ukraine. So that whole kind of situation leaves a funny taste.
But content-wise, it's completely obvious that Witkoff just took a list, a wish list from the Kremlin to Washington and said, this is what they want. And that was the foundation. Everything in this plan reads like something a Russian diplomat would put up together to make sure that they come out as victors of this conflict.
I mean, to me, It also feels like the United States is just very much in a hurry to get this over with, particularly because Trump said that he would solve this within the first 100 days, and that because he clearly, for some reason unknown to me, is very motivated to receive a Nobel Peace Prize. I feel like that's the last and final honor he can receive after already becoming US president twice. Now he wants to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, and therefore needs to solve as many as many conflicts as possible with a Trump peace, because he also, right, similarly to the Gaza peace plan, with this peace plan, he also puts himself as like the head of the board overseeing the implementation of all of this, which to me feels a little bit like this is him setting himself up for a post-Trump president time, because it never states in any of these documents that it's overseen by the US president, but it's overseen by the US president Donald Trump. Right, so I don't know about the legality of these writings in the end, but it's very much seems to be centered and focused on the wish list of the Russians, but also Donald Trump.
Well, like everything that comes out of the White House, right? Those narcissistic tendencies are clearly there. I don't know if it's about post-presidency or just to make clear that nobody can confuse this with Joe Biden or any previous president, right? That it's completely obvious that it's only Donald Trump who has done this. But the key word here is solving, right? And that's what I was referring to before a little bit, that in a proper peace negotiation process, there needs to be a reconciliation and a solution to problems at hand. And these processes that you just listed, that the United States is overseeing, are not processes of actually solving anything. They are processes of freezing the status quo. Here's a conflict. Let's stop fighting now. Let's have a ceasefire. Let's stop shooting at each other, killing each other, which, by the way, is great.
We like. We love that.
It's great when people don't shoot at each other, when people don't die on the battlefield. That's wonderful news. But there is no process of actually long-term sustainable solutions. It's not, therefore, a peace process. It is essentially a ceasefire that is being overseen by the Trump administration.
Well, let's look into this plan. I think for transparency, it makes sense to say that before the episode, we went through this plan and we thought, oh, let's only talk about the interesting points, or the, as we called it, the fun points, right? Where it's fun to add analysis. And then we realized after point 20 that we had only, that we basically included most of the points because there's something interesting to say about all of them, however, to different lengths. So we will just, I will read this, the full plan. I will read out loud and basically I will stop after each point and the two of us will comment quickly and provide our analysis.
Yeah, and It's completely obvious that, I mean, you could write a mini essay about almost each of them, right? I mean, there is a lot to talk about here.
Yeah. So starting with point number one of the full Trump 28-point peace plan. And point number one reads, Ukraine's sovereignty will be confirmed. Well, I mean, excellent.
Yeah. After an invasion that completely destroyed that sovereignty that had already been confirmed after the fall of the Soviet Union, right? So, and when Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons, well, to be honest, that whole bit of nuclear weapons given up, that's taken a little bit of life of its own. It's not as if Ukraine had a nuclear arsenal that they could use. It was part of the Soviet nuclear arsenal, but there was already a recognition of Ukrainian sovereignty. And then in 2014, Crimea was annexed against the will of the international community and Ukraine, obviously, and then a full-blown invasion in 2022. So, I mean, Ukraine's sovereignty will be confirmed is lovely until it won't, right? Apparently. Yeah.
I mean, also the question is, what is Ukraine in this moment, right? So are we, I mean, that's something that they will get into a little bit later. But what is part of Ukraine and Ukraine's sovereignty? It will be confirmed.
And every first year IR student gets to learn that sovereignty in our current system is territorial. It's territorial sovereignty. It depends on where you draw the lines. And those lines were drawn and now they are redrawn. And are they going to be redrawn in the future? Is at some point the idea that only Kiev is left like a city state that will represent Ukrainian people or something like that?
Yeah. Point number two, a comprehensive non-aggression agreement will be concluded between Russia, Ukraine, and Europe. All ambiguities of the last 30 years will be considered settled. That I always like, right? I would love to sign these types of things where all the ambiguities of my personal relations in the past, that they will be settled once and for all, right? And no more talking about them.
It's probably fair to say that Donald Trump is not a details person. All ambiguities of the last 30 years will be settled. Essentially saying, let bygones be bygones, look towards the future. Let's pretend that everything is okay now. Forgetting about, of course, even Georgia, right? This is also directly, Russia annexed parts of Georgia. That's now going to be, are we all supposed to agree on that? Is that now a done deal? Later on, they specifically mentioned Crimea and others, but it also means that Russia can basically claim that anything that in the past led to any kind of conflict should not be brought up anymore. What I find particularly interesting about this is that this is a plan essentially written by the Russians, delivered to Washington, and Trump made it, you know, gave it his own flair. And now all of a sudden, Europe has to also be part of this, right? So Russia, Ukraine, and Europe need to now agree on all of this, which is in some ways, to be fair, a sign of Russia saying to Europe, can we please stop this belligerent language, right? Because we've been saying this in the podcast over and over again. It's Europeans who are more belligerent in their language and in their investment in defense against Russia than the Russians are actually towards at least the European Union or NATO countries. So it is essentially a Russian attempt to say, okay, from now on, we're all good. Let's be friends.
My first question as a good IR student, I mean, because you mentioned writing an essay earlier, would be, please define Europe. What constitutes Europe? I mean, because according to my geographical understanding, Russia and Ukraine are part of Europe, at least parts of Russia. So who is Europe in this case? And I mean, they were also weren't at the table, right? So Europe was not included in this. And there's a few more points that we'll actually touch upon Europe later on.
Yeah. Again, I think it goes back to the Americans not being particularly interested in details, not really caring, and keeping it probably ambiguous on purpose as well, so that the details can be filled in later. Presumably, they're talking about the European Union and the main leaders, but yeah, that's completely unidentified here. That is undefined. Presumably, it also means that if some country that is not part of the European Union but is in Europe, that somehow raises their hand and says, hey, I've got a problem with this, then they are the weird outlier, because we agreed that the whole of Europe would become part of this, right? So you get a situation, I guess, in the Kremlin's mind, where they signed this agreement with Berlin and Paris or Brussels or whoever, and then everyone, whether you're part of the European Union or not, is supposed to basically accept it. It is just so stupid.
And it's also the beginning of this plan, and immediately states that the United States is not a stakeholder in this conflict, which is, of course, completely wrong. I mean, the United States very much is a stakeholder here, but presents itself as, we don't have any trouble with anyone. You children go sort out your difficulties and we'll kind of oversee it if you pay us.
If you pay us, yeah. I mean, at the very minimum, they're defining themselves as stakeholders financially here, right? Because they're basically typical Trump. They're basically later on saying, we need to be compensated for our great efforts because this is a European problem. This is not an American problem. And therefore, you should be grateful for all our hard work.
Yeah. Continuing with point number three, it is expected that Russia will not invade neighboring countries and NATO will not expand further. I mean, it's basically the Treaty of Westphalia, right? We kind of expect that you will not invade neighboring countries. That's not nice.
Well, it's even worse. It's like, it's almost as if the blame is here on Europeans. Like, how dare you expect that we do this, right? It's like they're basically saying, like, hey, you're not supposed to expect anything. Monty Python, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, right? It's this kind of idea of, well, don't expect us to invade. That's not nice of you. That's not a very friendly thing. It doesn't say Russia will not invade neighboring countries. It says just don't expect it, which, you know, it's just this kind of document. If my students would come up with this as a kind of peace plan or whatever they call it, I would be very disappointed. The fact that this comes out of the most powerful country in the world, and is endorsed by the most powerful president in the world, is to me just a huge indictment of the sad times we live in.
Well, and I mean, this kind of opposes point number one, that Ukraine's sovereignty will be confirmed, because, I mean, part of a sovereign country's basically decision-making arsenal is that they can choose to join NATO, and that choice is not being taken away from them.
We always knew, right, from the very beginning, that the NATO thing was a major element for the Russians. Arguably, it was one of the drivers that led to the invasion in the first place, because we know that Ukraine and NATO were negotiating. They were talking about accession into NATO. So, you know, but of course, yeah, either you're sovereign and you make your choices and NATO makes its choices, or you're not. I mean, it's one or the other. And that is something that, again, is a complete inconsistency here. Our argument in a podcast has always been that NATO should be very careful in expanding, because it is a belligerent, or at least an aggressive act towards Russia, that expansion. But the fact that Ukraine would like to join NATO seems obvious, and there's absolutely no shame in that.
Point number four, A dialogue will be held between Russia and NATO, mediated by the United States, to resolve all security issues and create conditions for de-escalation in order to ensure global security and increase opportunities for cooperation and future economic development. Walter, last time I checked, the United States was part of NATO.
It's astounding, this, right? That in Trump's mind, he can just step in and out of NATO whenever it suits him. So how can you have a conversation between Russia and NATO mediated by the most powerful, not just the most powerful, it's not even close, the only indispensable member of NATO? Without the United States, NATO doesn't have any meaning. Then you look at European defense forces and you know, maybe some kind of collaboration with Canada and the UK, but this sentence either is such a misunderstanding of what NATO is like, or, which is more likely, it is basically the United States signaling to other NATO countries, we don't feel actually we belong here, and if you're not careful, we're going to step out of it and you're on your own. Which, by the way, I think would be great news for Europe, but that's a whole different story.
Point number five, because we do have to move on. We've been, we need to get through another 23 points, and we've been slow. Point number five, Ukraine will receive reliable security guarantees. From whom? And who is reliable in today's world?
Yeah, well, this is all down to definition, right? We can be short. If you have a contract and it doesn't define what reliable receive or security guarantees mean, then it's completely meaningless. That has absolutely no meaning whatsoever.
Nope. Point number six, the size of the Ukrainian armed forces will be limited to 600,000 personnel. Well, I mean, poor Ukraine. What about the Russians? Why is only one party being limited? And again, sovereignty, right? That's a big part of your sovereignty is deciding how big your armed forces can be.
Yeah, and on top of that, it's where is Russia? It goes back to what we said at the very beginning. This is a wish list written down on a napkin by the Kremlin and given to Witkoff, who then took it to Trump. There is absolutely no agency that is given to Ukraine in any of this, but there's also no serious limitation on Russia. It would have been a completely different story, but that would have been the outcome of deep negotiations, which have never happened, of course, is if it said Ukraine is limited to 600,000 personnel and Russia is limited to 1 million or 1.5 million or whatever. But that's not the case here. It is all about limiting Ukraine, what Ukraine is not allowed to do. Whereas, and let us remember, it was the Russians who invaded. You know, there have been countless books written about the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War, and about the ridiculous conditions that were put on Germany and the other losers of the war. But at a very minimum, there was ambiguity about who started it and who not. And it was clear that, okay, so technically, Germany pulled the trigger, and then the Allied Allied forces won, and the Allied then imposed their victor's justice onto Germany and Austria-Hungary and the Ottomans. Okay, fine. In this case, it is the Russians who started all of this. Why is there no punishment for the Russians? Why is there no understanding whatsoever that Russia needs to be limited in its ability to do these things in the future?
No, Boller, that's not fair, because in point three it said it is expected that Russia will not be invading neighboring countries. I think that's a very harsh consequence. Yeah, I know. I agree. It's completely ridiculous. Point number seven. Ukraine agrees to enshrine in its constitution that it will not join NATO, and NATO agrees to include in its statutes a provision that Ukraine will not be admitted in the future. I mean, we've talked about this point beforehand, but this is again punishing Ukraine.
It's punishing Ukraine. It clashes with sovereignty, and again, I think that NATO has been making mistakes in its expansion policies. I don't think they should have done it, but Ukraine should absolutely, as a sovereign country, be entitled to ask for joining NATO. And the fact that, according to this, they're not, this goes back to the whole lack of agency and basically Russia's dream scenario.
Yeah. Point number eight. NATO agrees not to station troops in Ukraine, which I have a question about this part, because later on, spoiler, there's a part about, yes, Ukraine can join the EU. What if there's EU troops stationed in Ukraine and they happen to be NATO troops at the same time? It's such an amateurishly written document.
It's complete amateur hour here, because also, let's face it, the United States, without, by the way, being specific about it, says that it will provide guarantees later on. And those guarantees presumably means at least having some observers, at a minimum, American soldiers on the ground to make sure that everyone stays in their corner. Those, by definitions, would be NATO troops. This idea that NATO troops are blue helmets like the UN, like that you know, that clearly visible, like we are not here on behalf of our country, we are here on behalf of the United Nations, is, of course, insane. NATO troops are not specifically loyal to NATO, they're loyal to their NATO members who happen to be part of NATO. So the moment an American soldier sets foot on Ukrainian soil, then typically this would break the treaty, because they are NATO troops by the very definition that NATO itself uses.
Yeah, and what about all the consultants and the training personnel that Western countries already have in Ukraine? Right. Point number nine, European fighter jets will be stationed in Poland. That's already the case. Sorry.
I don't know why this point is there. I'm not sure. Maybe one of our listeners can enlighten us. But either it is just someone took some wrong notes somewhere and forgot to delete it. Or it is that the Russians want to make a gesture, like saying, hey, we understand that there are also some concerns on behalf of Europeans, so we're okay with European stationing jets in Poland. We're okay with that. I'm trying to speculate as in what is the thinking here? Because as you said, they are there. Of course they're going to be there. How is that related to anything else? If they mean any jets that were provided by the Europeans to Ukraine should now go back to Poland, then you need to specify that, of course, if that is the thinking. But that's not what it says in the text.
I mean, if I remember correctly, that was one of those points that was criticized for potentially being translated from Russian into English, and therefore some of the meaning was lost, because maybe they also use Google Translate or ChatGPT, who knows.
It should also be pointed out, again, this word European, right? I mean, can people please be, if you're going to create a document that deals with probably the most fundamental issue that humanity faces, war and peace, can you please try to be a little bit precise in your language? Can you please specify what you mean?
I disagree. I think the most fundamental issue humanity faces is climate change. But call me a hippie.
Fair enough.
Point number 10, the U.S. guarantee. The U.S. will receive compensation for the guarantee. If Ukraine invades Russia, it will lose the guarantee. If Russia invades Ukraine, in addition to a decisive coordinated military response, all global sanctions will be reinstated. A recognition of the new territory and all other benefits of this deal will be revoked. And if Ukraine launches a missile at Moscow or St. Petersburg without cause, the security guarantee will be deemed invalid. a bunch of points in here, but this is what you mentioned at the beginning about this being a Trump deal, is that the United States will be compensated, I assume financially or in the form of minerals or rare earths or whatever, for this, and the rest basically says that if you do something, of course, all of this will be revoked.
Well, the one good thing about this clause is that this is, I think, the only place where there is a tiny bit of asymmetry in favor of Ukraine. But it is meaningless because it's not well defined, like everything else in the document. But it says basically, hey, if Ukraine invades Russia, hey, then they're on their own. We're not going to do anything. But if Russia invades Ukraine, then there will be this decisive coordinated military response. But it doesn't say by whom. It doesn't say, will the United States be immediately attacking Russia? It will, you know, it will be like, it could be like what you've seen over the past 3 years. So it actually has very little value, but at the very minimum, this is the one clause where Ukraine comes out a tiny little bit better than the Russians, except for the fact that they probably are the ones who have to compensate the United States, of course.
I mean, I would like to see Russia compensating the United States here. And I mean, just hilarious at the end, right? This is why at the beginning I said there are some fun points in here, because they just, I don't know what else to do but to laugh at this, is the specifics, right? Because when they go into detail, they go into very random details, that if Ukraine launches a missile at Moscow or St. Petersburg without cause, the security guarantees will be deemed invalid. So Sochi is fine, right? The Ukraine can attack Sochi.
Again, such a weird, weird sentence, right? Is this because, did someone somewhere say, hey, you know, sometimes things can go wrong with missiles, and there might be a missile accidentally landing in a small village, and then we won't make a big deal out of it? Why specify Moscow or St. Petersburg? It doesn't make any sense. And I really would love to have seen the process of how we went through a wish list that was dictated somewhere in the Kremlin to basically giving that to Witkoff and the American delegation, then that being translated in the United States by Washington, and then put into this kind of form. It seems so amateur and so nonsensical. It's fascinating, but it's also horrifying. This is about real stuff. This is not some kind of high school project.
Well, moving on to point number 11. Ukraine is eligible for EU membership and will receive short-term preferential access to the European markets while this issue is being considered. And this is the moment when I again remind the listeners that within the EU treaties, there's also something similar to Article 5 of NATO. Right, more concrete, right? Because with NATO, it's more like, you should consider an attack against one of us is an attack against all of us, and we will all strike back. But the Europeans actually make this a little bit more concrete. So again, my question is, if Ukraine is in the EU, and then Ukraine is attacked by Russia, then all of the EU is going to have to basically strike back, and a lot of them are also within NATO. So Putin doesn't believe that the EU would ever do that, or he's done attacking Ukraine, and it could also be, or there's just an intensive lack of any knowledge on the matter.
Well, to that last point, I would certainly expect Putin to be done with attacking Ukraine for a while, probably for the rest of his life. I mean, he's burned himself here, right? I mean, we've talked about this a lot. He wants to finish this. He wants to finish the conflict because it hasn't been good for him. It hasn't been good for Russia, and I don't think there's any threat of him 2 years later immediately starting again. This is not about refueling and then going again, because then he might as well push on right now, given that the Russians are very slowly but surely winning.
But that's something that that all the security analysts out there are saying, right? Is that Russia is now refueling and it basically would continue to attack Ukraine, or Europe is next?
Yeah, indeed. And well, when you say all those security experts, you say all those security experts that are very, very deeply in the Western bubble and that need to listen to our podcast, because that doesn't make any sense, of course.
Absolutely.
Because Putin could also just say, I want a ceasefire for the next 3 months, and Ukraine would sign it no problem, because Ukraine is in worse state than Russia. So anyway, that's kind of what happened to the ceasefire with respect to Israel and Hamas earlier this year, right? December last year, where essentially Israel was out of bullets, needed to clean up its vehicles and all that. They had a ceasefire, and then afterwards they just continued to campaign. That is not what is happening here in Russia, Ukraine. But the other things about this, what you just read, is I just complained that Ukraine has no agency in any of this. Ukraine wasn't at the table. This is not a wish list that has been agreed upon with Ukraine. It is purely Russian. And now this is dictating terms to the European Union. Ukraine is eligible for EU membership. Well, we know it is because the Europeans have been having these conversations. I don't think it will ever get to anything, by the way. That's a whole different story. But and will receive short-term preferential access. This is the Americans and the Russians telling the Europeans who will receive preferential access to their market. That, of course, is complete insanity if you don't have European representatives at the table. The Europeans have asked for this themselves because of their weak approach to everything and not actually taking a stance. But it just shows that the sort of inherent arrogance between Moscow and Washington about dictating terms to everyone who somehow is involved. And yeah, then there's the final thing that you mentioned, like, okay, what is then exactly the practical difference between NATO and the EU? Well, probably that the United States is not responsible for it, right? So they are not part of the EU, but they are part of NATO. I will also say that the Russians in general have much less of a problem, a philosophical or almost emotional problem with the European Union than they do with NATO. They have from the very beginning, because of the birth of NATO being this opposing power against the Soviet Union, against the Warsaw Pact, they have always seen NATO as imperial. They don't see the European Union as inherently imperial, and they're happy to do business with the European Union. So again, for the Russians, it feels kind of more comfortable to have the EU there. However, in practical terms, it essentially comes down to the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you're smart about it, I would include a subpoint saying that the US will also receive preferential treatment to the European markets, right? I mean, I can at least be consequential. Jokes aside, point number 12, a powerful package of measures to rebuild Ukraine, including but not limited to the creation of a Ukraine development fund to invest in fast-growing industries, including technology, data centers, and artificial intelligence. The United States will cooperate with Ukraine to jointly rebuild, develop, modernize, and operate Ukraine's gas infrastructure, including pipelines and storage facilities. Joint efforts to rehabilitate war-affected areas for the restoration, reconstruction, and modernization of cities and residential areas. Infrastructure development, extraction of minerals and natural resources. And lastly, the World Bank will develop a special financing package to accelerate these efforts. I mean, this is really just the last things Trump could remember wish list, right? Of like, okay, AI, you know, I have a bunch of AI companies. We need data centers. I don't like anything renewable, so it will be gas infrastructure, right? And infrastructure development, because I love infrastructure. And lastly, I love minerals and natural resources, particularly the rare earths that are in Ukraine.
And I love other countries paying for it, because the World Bank means that it can be Japan and India and China who have to put money into all of this, right? And the Europeans, of course. Again, this is so reminiscent of the agreement, the ceasefire agreement around Israel and Hamas. It is so empty of any real meaning until you have all the fine print, until you actually discuss what does this mean, who does it, who benefits, who profits. It is basically an empty statement. But of course, it is Trump who wants to go back to the American people and says, look, I bring all these riches home from this conflict. And I do this because this is a European conflict, not an American conflict. And out of the goodness of our hearts, we are the ones who take responsibility here. And of course, we deserve to be paid for it. But it has absolutely zero meaning without being specific.
Point number 13. Russia will be reintegrated into the global economy. The lifting of sanctions will be discussed and agreed upon in stages and on a case-by-case basis. The United States will enter into a long-term economic cooperation agreement for mutual development in the areas of energy, natural resources, infrastructure, artificial intelligence, data centers, and rare earth metal extraction projects in the Arctic and other mutually beneficial cooperation opportunities. Lastly, Russia will be invited to rejoin the G8. So this is just the same list that we read out before, but instead of Ukraine, it applies to Russia. And the point that I think is very interesting is the one of the G8, because the G8, if you ask me, is essentially dead. I mean, it's who is it? What do they ever decide? I mean, they can't decide on any common communique because of the United States obstructing to it anyways. But it must be, similarly to the Nobel Peace Prize to Trump, a very sore point for Putin. Because why else would you want to, right? It's more like, oh, you kicked me out and now you have to have me back. But no one likes you there at the table anyways. So why would you want to go there? Because nothing will also be achieved. There's no relevance.
It seems like an ego thing. It's also this idea of Russia being seen as a global leader, right? If it hurts them when there is these powerful countries meeting up, even though they don't really decide anything important and it's just basically about business deals and all that. it hurts Moscow that they're not present, because they want the world to know, and they want the Russian people to know, that Russia is one of the big guys, is one of the big players on the world stage. So it's purely an emotional ego thing, that bit. The other interesting thing about this clause is that it's essentially saying Russia will not face any further negative consequences for its actions, right? For starting a voluntary war that led to hundreds of thousands of people dying, enormous destruction. Again, goes back to that let bygones be bygones. We forget about the past, we look forward, and let's all be friends.
Well, and the next point that we have to focus on, and that one is even more Trumpian, if I may call it that, is point number 14. Frozen funds will be used as follows. $100 billion in frozen Russian assets will be invested in US-led efforts to rebuild and invest in Ukraine. The US will receive 50% of the profits from this venture. Europe will add $100 billion to increase the amount of investment available for Ukraine's reconstruction. Frozen European funds will be unfrozen. The remainder of the frozen Russian funds will be invested in a separate US-Russian investment vehicle that will implement joint projects in specific cases. This fund will be aimed at strengthening relations and increasing common interests to create a strong incentive not to return to conflict. Again, I mean, very similar points to what we said before, but again, Europe isn't really being asked. Europe will provide an additional $100 billion without the Europeans knowing about this. And again, that the fact that a lot of these funds will be either invested into US companies doing that in Ukraine, and that 50% of the profits will go to the United States, which again, who is the US here? Is it the United States as a country, or is it companies? Loosely defined.
Oh, well, that last bit is very clearly Trump grifting, as he always does, right? Essentially using foreign policy as a grift to get money to places where he wants to, where he wants money to go. On top of which, he can then tell the American people, I'm bringing money to the United States. So it's basically someone who doesn't take foreign policy seriously in itself, but uses foreign policy to enrich his surroundings and very blatantly, more than is usual, for political gain at home. The lack of agency that is given here to Europe, and for a document like this just to say, oh, Europe will add $100 billion, no problem, is of course just an enormously kind of disrespectful, rude gesture towards Brussels and European capitals. And if European leaders had a little bit more spine, they would react to this, right? But Europe is so rudderless, not knowing how it wants to position itself towards Trump, and not knowing when to draw the line and where to draw the line. Trump can get away with this kind of nonsense.
The next point is a particularly interesting one to me. Point 15. A joint American-Russian working group on security issues will be established to promote and ensure compliance with all provisions of this agreement. That's the OSCE. We already have an organization like this. It was established, what was it, 1978, Helsinki Accords? And actually one of the international organizations that I was always a big fan of, because it was a very efficient one, in my opinion. But of course it died then a few years ago with the Russian invasion.
And once again, lacking any kind of agency for anyone else, right? And I keep on hammering on this, because we know this is a Russian document that has then been filtered by the White House through the US administration. But the complete disregard for any other actors into this, a joint American-Russian working group, you just told the Europeans that they had to pay $100 billion. You're doing this about Ukraine, which has been invaded by the Russians. Why is this an American-Russian working group? Of course, the answer is that this is not a serious proposal. It is purely a Russian, you know, dream list of what they would like to see. But it says a lot about 2025 that this is now the way that foreign policy gets enacted.
Also, there's no coherence in this in these 28 points, right? There's no story being told, which is at least the minimum I would expect, because point 16 reads, Russia will enshrine in law its policy of non-aggression towards Europe and Ukraine. That's kind of a repetition of point number 3, that it's expected that Russia will not invade neighboring countries and NATO will not expand further. right? And I mean, also enshrining things in law, policy of non-aggression, and so on. I mean, that's it's just so far-fetched. And then even then, I mean, the regard for the law on for both parties, right, the United States and Russia, when it comes to going to war, I think the track record shows.
Of course, even if any kind of symbolic gesture would be made in this regard, right? So even if the Russians, if the Kremlin were to be able to put something in onto paper, it's all about how you phrase it. And in the most likely scenario, the phrasing will make it completely pointless. It will be something along the lines of, hey, we do not intend to do anything unless we are being acted upon. And then it all comes down to how the Russians interpret being acted upon. So these kinds of sentences have no meaning. The only thing that they are there for is to vaguely signal to the rest of the world that Russia has relatively peaceful intentions. By the way, which is something that I believe. I do not believe that Russia has a aggressive plan to invade Europe or other countries at the moment. I don't think there's any evidence for that, unlike what the Europeans are saying. However, a sentence like this is completely meaningless, of course.
Well, I mean, we can... this is actually an interesting point. After how many failed special military operations, does a country realize it cannot continue like this? Because if we look at the United States, it took a few more. Except military aggression towards Ukraine. There's of course the existing situations in Georgia and also in Moldova. But my first question again would be: are they even included in this definition of Europe?
Okay, again, the terms are completely undefined and it's not at all clear. But that's what I mean. Adding a sentence or adding some kind of law legislation in Russia is meaningless if it's not extremely well defined and very well formulated. And of course it's not going to be well defined. And of course it's not going to be well formulated. Why would they? I mean, there's absolutely no reason for them to. There's nothing specific in this list that they actually have to follow up on. And there's no pressure from them. It's all about the symbolism and saying, hey, we Russians are just a peaceful people and we just want peace with Europe and all that.
Point number 17. The United States and Russia will agree to extend the validity of treaties on the non-proliferation and control of nuclear weapons, including the START 1 treaty. Which, I mean, that point is relevant because the new START, right, so the last major US-Russia arms control treaty will expire in, I think, 6 weeks, so in February of 2026.
I mean, this is one of the things that I can stand behind. Any conversations about proliferation or anti-proliferation, non-proliferation, especially between the United States and Russia, is good news, right? Let them please talk about this, and let's make sure that we've got good mechanisms in place to ensure that nobody presses the wrong button and we don't all of a sudden find ourselves in World War III. That is all good. There's nothing bad about this. I don't really understand why this point is added to this list, though. How it's related to the situation with Ukraine.
Because then Trump can claim he stopped the expansion of nuclear weapons, which he also tries to do in point 18. Ukraine agrees to be a non-nuclear state in accordance with the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, as it did in 1990.
We've been here already, just like the whole sovereignty thing, right? That was set at the very beginning of this list. The moment the Soviet Union fell and Ukraine became an independent country, they agreed to be a non-nuclear state, and they transferred their weapons to Russia, to the Russian Republic, and they were given territorial sovereignty. And so, yeah, you can put this in here. As far as I'm aware, I don't think Ukraine has any time or energy to actually dedicate to nuclear weapons at the moment anyway. I don't think it's a big deal either way. But of course, it's a little bit bitter that this now gets put into this text as if Ukraine has to somehow show its goodwill, whereas Ukraine has never deviated from its initial promises.
I mean, this ties into a larger conversation that we've had before as well about why do countries want to develop nuclear weapons? And this reminds me a little bit of Iran, right? I mean, the only reason why Ukraine or Iran would want to develop nuclear weapons is because they have been attacked by global powers in the past. And if you look at North Korea and some other countries, this appears to be one of the few ways that you can actually prevent any such attacks against you. So, I mean, maybe they're projecting here.
It might be, and there's certainly an argument, right? If you're Ukrainian, and this is not about now, I mean, Ukraine needs all its efforts to fight back against the Russians, but there is a serious argument that if you're Ukrainian and you want to find another way to protect yourself against future Russian aggression, which of course you do, that developing nuclear weapons would be the way to go. The problem, of course, that Ukraine faces is that it is developing nuclear weapons is not really compatible with its other foreign policy goals. Getting within the EU, having reasonable relations with the United States. So they're in a tough spot, whereas for a country like Iran, it is much more of a no-brainer. And then the fact that Iran hasn't got the nuclear weapons means that it's probably because of religious, moral reasons, just as they've been saying, right? Iran has no other reason not to develop nuclear weapons, whereas Ukraine clearly does.
Moving on, point 19, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant will be launched under the supervision of the IAEA, and the electricity produced will be distributed equally between Russia and Ukraine, 50-50. Ah, what a nice symbol for peace.
Yeah, it's also bitter, right? I'm not Ukrainian, so I don't. But if I, as a Ukrainian, saw this list, it is so painful, because it's like, why? Hang on, how come that Russia is being rewarded for this act of war like this? How come that United States is okay with that? This list goes way further than any reasonable honest broker would propose, obviously, because we're not talking about an honest broker here. But the idea of a proper peace process ever rewarding Russia by giving 50% of this, by giving all this territory, by giving all these kinds of guarantees to Russia, not to Ukraine, is just a sign of the weakness of Ukraine, and by extension, the weakness of Europe, the EU specifically, and large EU members, and the complete absence of a desire to maintain international order by the United States, right? The White House is not interested in any kind of international justice or international kind of consistency. It's all about immediate short-term gain.
So in conflict resolution, right, there's a difference between kind of peacemaking and peace creating, where there's the measures, right, that kind of imposed from the outside to create peace and to impose it. And then making peace is focused on actually solving any of the underlying issues. And maybe point 20 has a chance here, and I quote, "Both countries undertake to implement educational programs in schools and society aimed at promoting understanding and tolerance of different cultures and eliminating racism and prejudice." These are DEI measures. This is now me commenting, sorry. And I'll continue. Ukraine will adopt EU rules on religious tolerance and the protection of linguistic minorities. Both countries will agree to abolish all discriminatory measures and guarantee the rights of Ukrainian and Russian media and education. All Nazi ideology and activities must be rejected and prohibited. That was point 20. Again, I mean, I repeat my joke about the DEI measures, and I think it's hilarious that the Trump administration, after canceling all of that in the United States, is now calling for it in Russia and Ukraine.
It's nice that the only time that they actually specify EU rather than Europe is when they want to weaponize internal structures within the EU for this, right? The vague term of all of this makes it kind of unworkable and not particularly important in any practical sense, but it is essentially sending a signal to Ukraine, you better not oppress Russian minorities anymore. That's basically what it's saying. And then the Nazi ideology that must be rejected and prohibited, this goes back, harks back all the way to Putin justifying the invasion by saying that there are Nazis in Kiev that need to be removed. So even though it has very little practical meaning and it's like it's empty rhetoric, it is also rhetoric that basically tells Ukraine, be careful, if we ever believe that you are prosecuting Russians, or if Russians do not get their fair share of internal politics, then you'll be breaking this agreement.
Point number 22, territories. Crimea, Luhansk, Donetsk will be recognized as de facto Russian, de facto just throws me off. That's so funny. Including by the United States, Kherson and Zaporizhia will be frozen along the line of contact, which will mean de facto recognition along the line of contact. Russia will relinquish other agreed territories it controls outside the five regions. Ukrainian forces will withdraw from the part of Donetsk Oblast that they currently control, and this withdrawal zone will be considered a neutral demilitarized buffer zone, internationally recognized as a territory belonging to the Russian Federation. Russian forces will not enter this demilitarized zone. This is hilarious. All of this is really funny.
Well, yeah, funny in a way that you have to cry about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you can only read this. I mean, I don't know, like, reading it over and over again, and now reading it out loud, it still made me chuckle. Like, this is so just wrong, bad, stupid. It's so clearly Russian authored. And the fact that the United States just said, oh, you know what, let us take this over, and it just seems like a good idea, and let us propose this to Ukraine, to me is mind-boggling, and just shows the, it almost feels like the United States is a Russian actor here.
And the word amateurish comes to mind once again, right? So to be clear, so Ukraine is now forced to give up territory that they're still defending, that is not at the moment occupied by Russia. And then there is this sentence, Russia will relinquish other agreed territories it controls outside the five regions. There are no serious other territories that Russia is controlling. What are they talking about? I mean, so it is basically like, oh, let's make sure that it looks balanced. But there is no balance about this. It's completely unbalanced. And once again, it is giving a country that started this war, that invaded another sovereign territory without any kind of international support or justification, this enormous kind of presence. Basically, here you are rewarded for your efforts, and the Ukrainians just have to swallow it. I mean, we can have all kinds of conversations, as we did in the past, about, you know, how we got to this stage and how the West, Europeans and Americans were responsible for basically encouraging Ukraine to continue this war, encouraging Ukraine to keep on fighting when they could have had a better outcome earlier on during the war. However, if you forget about that for 1 second and just look at this, this is a criminal document. It's an incompetent document, it's an amateurish document, but it's also criminal. It has absolutely no respect for any basic international decency.
Let's look at the last few points. 22, after agreeing on future territorial arrangements, both the Russian Federation and Ukraine undertake not to change these arrangements by force. Any security guarantees will not apply in the event of a breach of this commitment. Well, kind of a repetition of things we've read before.
And I love that kind of pseudo-legal language at the end, right? Any security guarantees will not apply in the event of a breach of this commitment, as if this is a contract, except that it is a contract without any specificity. It has no clarity whatsoever about the conditions that can be breached in any way. But they try to, it's exactly a high school project. It sounds like a 13-year-old who tries to create a peace treaty without any understanding of what he's actually doing. That's what this looks like.
Yeah. Disclaimer for the next point. It will sound like it's something good for Ukraine, but I have a hunch that this is more about US interest to export materials through waterways. Because point 23 reads, Russia will not prevent Ukraine from using the Dnieper River for commercial activities, and agreements will be reached on the free transport of grain across the Black Sea. I mean, again, I think we can move on to the next part, because that's very much about the US wanting to export export the minerals it's sourcing from Ukraine elsewhere. Point 24, a humanitarian committee will be established to resolve outstanding issues. Wait a second. I'm already going to interrupt this, because earlier in the point set, it said in point two that all ambiguities of the last 30 years will be considered settled. This is directly right contradicting this. But just to read it fully, right? So the outstanding issues are: all remaining prisoners and bodies will be exchanged on an all-for-all basis. All civilian detainees and hostages will be returned, including children, because the Ukrainians have captured so many Russian children. Right? Again, that was commentary. A family reunification program will be implemented, and measures will be taken to alleviate the suffering of the victims of the conflict. End quote. I mean, yeah, sorry, I already commented in between, but this is just a funky business here.
Yeah, no, and here's the thing, right? Someone could say, hey, Dario, hey, Balder, this is just a outline. Of course, they have to work out the details later. But the problem with this is that if this had been a UN committee, right, with all kinds of different countries, and they say, we're going to set up a committee that's going to deal with these issues, then okay, of course, we understand that it takes a while to make sure that we know what we're talking about. But there is absolutely no honest broker here. So the fact that there's no specificity and there's just a weird list of things also suggesting that both sides are equally to blame and that both sides have done exactly the same thing. And then based on the United States or this humanitarian committee without any specificity, their perspective, these things have to be resolved, is of course laughable. I mean, that's a problem, right? If this had been the General Assembly appointing a committee, if you have to the Security Council appointing a committee to deal with these things, and that committee would have said, hey, we need the next couple of months to develop a good family reunification program to alleviate the suffering of the victims. Okay, fine, fair enough, take your time. But in this case, you just know that if, which is not going to happen, but if this were to be signed as a document tomorrow, then you just know that 6 months down the line, none of this will actually have any meaning or will be implemented in any practical way.
Yeah. The next one just reads like a punishment of Zelensky by Trump and Putin, because Ukraine will hold elections in 100 days, which, I mean, fair, because the elections have been delayed for obvious reasons. You can't hold elections in a territory that you don't control, right? but I mean, Putin wanted to get rid of Zelensky from the very beginning, and Trump also, remember, the whole Oval Office stunt has a dislike for Zelensky.
Yeah, and again, I become very repetitive, I understand that, but the emphasis on Ukraine having to do things, it's just so dark. It's just so, Ukraine defended itself against a foreign invasion. Why is Ukraine being punished? Why is Kiev being punished in all of this, right? We know why the Russians want this. I mean, I completely understand why the Russians, but that the Americans, that nobody in the White House raises their hand and says, hang on, there's something a little bit off here. Why is Ukraine continuously targeted for all kinds of restrictions and duties and obligations? And why aren't we talking about the Russians in any way like that? If I were an American citizen, I would be so ashamed of this.
Wait, well, we are talking about the Russians now in point 26. All parties involved in this conflict will receive full amnesty for their actions during the war and agree not to make any claims or consider any complaints in the future.
Putin wants to go to the Riviera again and wants to enjoy life and wants to be able to travel without being arrested. Now, by the way, I've never been a fan of the ICC issuing an arrest warrant for Putin. The ICC is overstepping its bounds in many ways. However, this is so blatantly just Russian oligarchs wanting to get their way again.
Yeah, and if you ask me, also kind of Trump protecting himself for other actions that he may have done, committed as U.S. president.
Yeah, I think of all the things that Trump is worried about when it comes to legal prosecution, Ukraine is not the one that he thinks most about, right?
Yeah, no, not at all Ukraine, right? But we just talked about Venezuela last week.
So anyone who signs this document will be immune to any prosecution relating to anything they've done.
Okay. I mean, not exactly like this, right? But as a precedent for future agreements, right? Mm. Of like, oh, you know, this is the second to last point or third to last point. We will always include this because it's just nasty, those legal battles, right? I mean, Trump has so many of them already. But okay.
Fair enough. Like,
point 27. This agreement will be legally binding, Its implementation will be monitored and guaranteed by the Peace Council, headed by President Donald J. Trump. Sanctions will be imposed for violations. Sounds very similar to the Gaza Peace Agreement, where Trump is also heading the Peace Council.
Yeah, and in order to make sure that nobody thinks it was Biden or nobody thinks it was any other president in the future that did this, it's not the president of the United States. It is Donald J. Trump, very specifically. I mean, I don't know, right? It's the Nobel Peace Prize Committee has made very clear that they're not fans of Donald Trump. There's no doubt, or even statements afterwards and all that. So, but if he had taken one marketing expert and asked, how do I get, or is one kind of lobbyist, and how do I get the Nobel Peace Prize? This is not it. This is just way over the top. The person who desperately, desperately wants the prize is not going to get it, because it is just such a blatant exercise in self-aggrandizement. It often astounds me about the Trump administration, right? A lot of people build enormous conspiracy theories around them, enormous like theories about how they want to bring fascism to the world. And I just look at this and I just think, incompetence. These people do not know what they're doing.
Point 28, Donald J. Trump, President Donald J. Trump, will receive the Nobel Peace Prize for the enormous achievements laid down in this agreement. No, I'm completely making this up. Point 20, but honestly, how many of the listeners actually believe this was true? Because based on everything, right, we've just heard, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that passage had made it in there. But point 28, once all parties agree to this memorandum, the ceasefire will take effect immediately after both sides retreat to the agreed points to begin implementation of the agreement.
Yeah, so that means when the Ukrainians withdraw their positions, essentially. Yeah. It's a sad... Whenever you say, hey, this, I find this very funny, I have something like, God, I wish I could find this funny, but I just get so sad by this. I get sad about the state of the world that the United States believes that documents like this actually should be even anywhere near their radar screen, that they are, both in style and in content, this has no place in international relations. It's just a badly written document. It is sad because it means that the United States and the White House have absolutely no sense of historical, you know, karma or justice, or don't even pretend to accept the fact that Russia were the aggressors, and that it is not Ukraine that should be limited, it is Russia that should be limited in any kind of agreement like this. So it is just a very, very sad document. Now, this document is not going to go much further in its current form. That's very clear. The Russians themselves, which is almost too absurd for words, have already expressed that they are not very happy with how the United States is moving on at this moment. So this document is not going to be signed in its current form by Zelensky or by anyone else. But of course, every time something like this gets published, it pushes Kiev further into a corner. And at some point, they won't have much choice but to accept something along these lines, which, if I were Ukrainian, would be like a very dark day.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the 28-point peace plan. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I've got a quote from Peter Bergen, who is a journalist, also a foreign policy advisor for various administrations in the United States. And this quote is kind of reminiscent of what I just said before when it comes to the White House and the amateurish approach that it's taken towards foreign policy, even towards their explicit goals of just trying to get the peace prize for Donald Trump. The quote goes, "Incompetence is a better explanation than any conspiracy in most human activity."